Welcome down to my 9-foot homemade oak bar. Pour yourself a cold one. You are listening to Bucks in the Basement. My name's Chris, and Craig here is the biggest Pirates fan you'll ever meet. Let's talk Pirates baseball now. Welcome to Bucks in the Basement.
Now I see the changes in this town. They change, they say one thing, but then the next day.
Guests that we're going to hear from in just a little bit.
Well, we've already had Eric Minshall on before, former Pirates pitching coach down in Bristol, now working for the Southern Illinois Miners. He also has the Cincinnati Throwing Club. And then we have former major leaguer Scott Siebel on, who is now he's the hitting coach for the Double A Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, and that is in the Marlins organization. And Gary Morgan and myself just kind of wanted to talk to a pitching coach versus a hitting coach just to kind of see how they develop players. Also, some of the adjustments are going to be made with possibly taking out a level and how players are going to adjust to that and what makes a good major league coach, because as you know, everybody says they always pick out guys on the roster who can, oh, this guy's going to be a coach. This guy's going to be a coach. And most of the major league players they say that about don't end up becoming coaches. It's the guys who either struggle through the minors or the guys that, you know, maybe make the major league squad, but they're just kind of like a role player or a catcher, or, you know, something where it's like a backup catcher role, then it becoming a good manager. So we wanted to talk to them a little bit about that. It was a great conversation. After that, I got into this Twitter battles, Chris.
We're going to do the Twitter argument after we play the interview. How's that? So the names of who we're talking to tonight: Eric Minshall, my life partner, my friend, and who else?
Scott Siebel.
All right, and Gary Morgan does most of the talking, although I believe that we hear you on it for a little bit. Bucks in the Basement, found everywhere podcasts can be found, and always at bucksinthebasement.com.
You're a batting coach. Eric's a pitching coach. What happens when you're facing each other? When you're on the same team, how does that dynamic work? Do you end up helping each other, or do you kind of stand off in opposition because you're teaching opposing skills? I've always been curious about that interaction. Eric, why don't you start?
Well, my experience last year was that you're very busy in the beginning, especially during spring training, and then going into extended. You are so busy, it's very hard to collaborate with anyone else. However, there were many, many days, and I think, Scott, I think you're friends with another friend of mine, John Nunley, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I spent a lot of time just walking over. When we were done with the day, a lot of the hitters were doing extra work or specific work, et cetera, and they were trying out new technologies. So I would stand in there with John Nunley, both the Eckstein brothers. I think Scott, you played with David.
Yes,
ever. When that 2005 came, yeah, what a great, great human being. And it was just for me to listen and watch. There was nothing I could offer, but I did want to hear about how they were going about their job, what pitches they were trying to dial in on, how they were teaching these guys to be patient. And you could learn so much literally from the other side. So once we got the season started and you can kind of take a breath, we got to Bristol. Our hitting coach, J.P. Prieto, really good job of preparing his guys. We did really well as a hitting club. I think it might have been Pulaski and us at the top. at the end of the year, if I'm not mistaken. And it all came down to preparation. But when we did our scouting reports, and this is something that Scott and I can kind of play off each other here with, is we would really – I would get all my reports on the hitters, and then JP would take a look at it. And then he would get all the reports on the Yankees pitchers, and then I would take a look at it. We would just basically get together in our manager's meeting before the series and really break down what we were seeing via True Media, what we were seeing, any reports that we'd had from any of the scouts that had been through, were they matching up, and any video that we had on. So we would actually collaborate quite a bit pre-series on what we were seeing, and most of this information is spot on. So the collaboration piece really, really helped out. Because one thing I couldn't identify as a pitching coach very easily, yes, the statistics said he was hitting a particular pitch where, but during a game, guys are making adjustments. They're trying to get better. So we would try to zero in on, yeah, they may have this information saying, no, we're going to pitch in a particular place. Is he making an adjustment? And it was far easier for our hitting coach and our manager to kind of say, yeah, he's closer to the plate than we thought he was going to be, or et cetera. And Scott, you can probably take it from there.
Yeah, that was that was perfect, everything you said. Spring training is tough. You're usually overloaded with about 25 to 30 hitters on your own, and I know the pitching coaches have a lot more than they usually have, so there's not a lot of collaboration going on. But once we do break and get to our cities, like you said, take a breath. The number one thing for me on any good staff, that includes the manager, everybody, is communication. I think I've been very, very fortunate to be with the staff that I've been. I've only been coaching for 4 years now, but the one thing I was very fortunate was all the coaches that I've been with so far, we've always checked our ego at the door, and we understood that even though you're a pitching coach, you're a baseball guy. You see things as well. You see hitters, and as a hitting coach, we're baseball people. We see pitchers, we see defenders. And I think the one thing that we've always, the groups that I've been with so far, is we understand that everybody knows baseball. So there's nothing wrong with me asking a pitching coach what they see in a hitter. For example, we had a nice player, and I know you might remember the name, Eric, is Madison Santos. This kid, this kid's about 5'6" and as much power as anybody. Yeah, but he at times he just scuffles. And I remember the pitching coach telling me in spring training, listen, he's going to struggle with fastballs in when the season starts. And this kid was hitting 320 in spring training with 7 home runs and extended. I'm like, I know he's going to struggle with something, but it wasn't evident to me at the time. And he had already pinpointed, he's like, if I was going to pitch against him, my plan would be to speed him up inside and go soft away. So we were able to tailor his work without even him knowing it, to be honest with you. Tailored his work to what we felt like his weakness was going to be simply because the pitching coach recognized it. And you have to respect the staff you're with and respect what they know. And everything Eric said is spot on. The communication point is huge. The data that we have now, the information we have now. So many times during the season, I would ask my pitching coach, you know, a certain player is either going well or he's not going well. And I would say, how would you pitch him right now? And then they would tell me, and the guys would be spot on. Like, if I was facing against Cabello right now, I would do breaking ball, speed him up, breaking ball, speed him up, and he's an out. And wow. Sometimes the hitting coach, it's obviously the hitting coach, but sometimes I like to hear that. Like, it kind of reassures you that it's that obvious that, okay, I am right. I'm on the right path here, so we're going to continue working. But for me, it's everything Eric said is spot on, and for me, it's communication. You got to trust the staff you're with, respect them, and if you work together, man, you can really do some good things to these players.
I mean, I certainly have more questions to follow up here, but I want to throw it back to Craig real quick because he is not just an audio tech. He is a he's a minor league baseball guru, and I want to hear what he has to ask.
Well, my biggest question I was thinking of when I was like just listening to you guys talk and everything is that you both have had success in your careers, and they have all these articles out about who's going to be like the next player who's, you know, going to be a manager when they retire. And it's all like these big name players and stuff. But a lot of times you see the guys that are the most successful are the guys that have had to quote unquote struggle throughout their careers. And they're the ones that somehow become like these great managers or these great hitting coaches, pitching coaches. And I'll start with Scott on this one, so Eric doesn't take all your answers. what do you think is like the qualities or maybe like the journey that makes like somebody a good pitching coach or a hitting coach or a manager? Like what gets them to that point?
I think the first thing that you need to have is a good person. I mean, take baseball aside from it. You have to have a good person, a sincere person, somebody who really wants to teach and help. You can know more baseball than Pete Rose, because Pete Rose claims he knows the most baseball in the world, and he might. I would want a high character person to start with, and then it doesn't hurt the fact that a player may have struggled in his career, because this game's tough, and everybody's going to struggle at times. And sometimes you take a 19-year-old kid who's from San Diego, and he's in Bristol, Tennessee, or he's in Pulaski, Virginia. You're the only hope he has. And how you respond to this kid is going to make or break his career. And I think a high character person has to take into consideration that, you know, I have this kid's livelihood in my hands. It's a big responsibility. And I think that's the kind of person I would want to kind of handle that situation. Obviously, once we get past the high character and the actual caring and want to teach and want to help young players is obviously knowledge. A lot of players, I mean, I don't know how you can say this. Like, I mean, who's a better hitter ever than Barry Bonds? I mean, I think he could still be hitting home runs if he was playing. But I couldn't imagine him being a hitting coach in a rookie ball or an A ball just simply because the game is too easy for him. I feel like understanding the struggles of the game, understanding the nuances of the game, being open to new things. I think a lot of the old players, the old coaches, they kind of get a kind of like a reputation of old school. And I think a good coach today is a person who is willing to learn and accept new things while trusting their beliefs.
The truth. I will say this. I had a really good conversation with Mark DeJean, who is the minor league field coordinator for the Cardinals. He retired last year, 40 years in baseball. And it was the last day of the regular season in the Happy League. We were facing off against Johnson City. And so I'm on the field before the game. We talked at length. And we were talking about the old school, new school. And he said, you know, Eric, I really like to consider myself middle school. And it really hit me. I have done probably a dozen speeches this offseason, and I've used that every time because it's so true now. You can't invalidate what a coach, you know, I've been coaching literally since I was 21 years old. So I'm in my 25th year. You can't invalidate all the things that you've seen. Those make you who you are. Those experiences are important. But like I was talking about the certification earlier, the way I'm looking at things now and the things I'm learning are absolutely completely different than the things I was doing 25, 20, 15, and even 10 years ago, and even 5 years ago. I was listening to Ron Wolfert and Randy Sullivan in a podcast the other day, and I had to pull over my car and write something down. We're talking about old school, new school, and the approach is the gratification for the coach should be the realization of something new. Like, oh, I just learned something that I can teach these players. Or, wow, we just had a breakthrough. It shouldn't be, oh, that's new information. I don't need any of that. I've never used any of that before. I don't need to talk to a player about that. I've been doing it this way for 30 years. That's when you know there's a complete separation. And those guys are being phased out. And probably rightfully so, to be honest.
Kind of touching on that, do you feel it's easier from the level that you're coaching at, both of you, when you get a college player or you get a high school player? Do the college players sometimes come in with a predetermined idea of what they want to do? Or,
well, we had this past year. We get quite a few, you know, draft picks, and we get guys from Louisville and Coastal Carolina and Georgia Tech, and you'd be surprised what they don't know. I will say I was pleasantly surprised that they were open-minded. I didn't really have many high school guys. A lot of those guys went to the GCL, so I really can't comment on that particularly, but at the same time, I did have several guys in my rotation. This was their first year in pro ball coming over from the Dominican. So I guess you could consider that similar to high school. But they were all open-minded. They hung on every word that we said to them. As Scott alluded to earlier, you're their only hope. So if you build a rapport and trust, they should be very open-minded to anything that you have to say. It doesn't mean that they can't disagree with you. That's fine. As long as they have a valid reason, I don't have any problem with that. But I didn't really experience anybody pushing back.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think when a player gets drafted out of college or high school, they're hungry. They're anxious. They're excited. They want to learn. I think more so I had a problem with a player doing everything I said instead of asking why. You know, I was like, well, slow down. You know, you don't even know why you're doing this. Something that I've been preached to as a coach is we want to make sure our players are okay and comfortable asking us why. Because I think the best way to make a player better is for them to understand what they're doing. And it makes me a better coach knowing that if I tell Eric to do something, I better know why. I better have a really good understanding of why I'm making this player do something, because he might ask me why, and I better have an answer for him. And that builds the trust that you're talking about. As far as the lower level coaching goes, I think lower level coaching, when you get to a rookie ball and even a low A ball, for me, it's probably harder than it is the upper levels. They're trying to basically earn the trust of these players. And I know Eric can attest to this. You get a lot of first-year players, especially in high school. 80% of your job is not really baseball-related. It's basically teaching these guys how to be professionals. Young kids, first time with my high school, they might have a little bit of money. Keeping them focused on why they're there. And the one thing nobody talks about is rookie ball, especially in the Appalachian League, we have a lot of Latina players. And when the Latina players get to a place like Bristol or Elizabethton or Pulaski, it's not easy to eat. A lot of the things that we do is making sure these players are eating, making sure they're sleeping, making sure they're staying in touch with their families, making sure they're staying strong. And after all those things, we got to make sure they're performing in baseball. Because the unfortunate truth to a lot of this is a lot of these kids' families depend on their success. So I think building the trust early on, and these kids come in and they want to get better. They want to learn. They want to learn. They want to learn. You got to slow them down. Like, listen, this is a process. Trust the process. You know, trust your ability. We're going to get better, but you know, we just have to stay the course.
That was a good interview. I liked it. Craig, jump back on, buddy. So, that was it. There he is. I want to apologize right away, buddy. For some reason, I've played back stuff that we've put together in advance before. For some reason, the equipment activated the microphone that was attached to it, and I couldn't get the thing to turn off. So if you heard any thumping,
you're good, man.
I think at some point during it, at least in my headphones, I could hear my wife chasing a child while he screamed no in terror because he obviously pissed his mother off and was going to get his ass whooped upstairs. So I didn't know if that came across in the background, but if you listened very closely, you might have heard it in the background of the interview. What did you take from that more than anything else? Because you've now heard it originally and you've heard it now a second time. What came from that stuck out to you the most in that interview?
I mean, what stuck out to me to the most in that interview would have to be the way that Eric and Scott each approach their players. You could be like the greatest baseball mind, and this is not playing. I mean, I know Eric's probably listening to this right now. It's not playing, like, but it's a lot of the stuff they were talking about is, you know what, you have to have this baseball knowledge, but you also have to be able to convey it to the players. And especially at those lower levels, to get them to buy into whatever system they're going to be playing in, whatever, you know, techniques that they're going to be using, you have to get them to buy into it. And the thing that got me was a player that's just basically saying, not asking any questions, but is just doing is what was told to him. I mean, he could have success, but they want a player that's also wanting to grow themselves and look at a situation and say, okay, why are you making me do this? Because I thought this was working for me, you know, so why am I doing this? You know, why am I doing something different? And those are like the two things I got from that. There was a part of the interview we kind of broke up a little bit after that, where I talked with Eric and Scott both about what happens when, you know, that minor league contraction possibly happens and you take out almost an entire level. And the thing that I got from them, especially from Eric, I know Eric's listening. If he wants to jump on, he can tell exactly what he was saying before. But it was just like, are we going to move guys up quicker than they need to be moved up? Are we going to hold guys back instead of like bumping them up? Because it's like they're going to be jumping like almost like a level and a half as opposed to a level. You know, so that's the stuff I gathered from all of that. And it was a great conversation. I can't wait to have, you know, both of those guys back on at some point.
Well, Eric Mitchell, my man crush, is on the line right now. Eric, my friend, how are you?
I'm doing great. This has been a really fun night.
Well, I'm sorry that I cut out some of, you know, it was weird. I don't know if you remember in the interview because Craig sent it to me and he's like, oh, you just got to listen to it. There might be something you have to fix. There was a point where you didn't get cut off. But when everybody got added back onto the line, your mic got completely screwed up. So I had to cut some of the stuff that you talked about. So I'm glad that you jumped on because that is an interesting question. Like, what do you do if you're going to cut out all these minor league teams? Because the way that I see it is what baseball is basically saying is a lot of these guys don't make it. A lot of these guys that aren't high prospects don't make it anyway. So what does it matter? And that's a cold way to look at it. But it's an interesting argument to make because a lot of guys don't make it. So what is the impact in your mind if you're going to take away, I think it's like 40 teams or something like that from the minors and basically erase the level of the minor leagues?
A couple different ways to look at that. You know, if that's the case, if everybody's just so smart that they don't need all these teams and, well, nobody's going to make it, and we know who's going to make it because that argument's been made by a couple of GMs. Which is really silly. That is absolutely almost unfathomable. Then just have a AAA team and get it over with. Just have one team and watch everybody suffer. And, you know, whoever rises to the top, then that's your squad. Those are your prospects. The point we made in the interview was with taking out the short season, you're now saying, because they want to keep all the GCL teams. So you're going to put the lowest level of minor league guys in the GCL, which they've been doing for years, and then you're going to have them jump to low A ball. And I got to be honest with you, Neiman Scott said the same thing. That's a big jump. You know, I feel embarrassed for the two GMs that came up with this idea and pushed it forward and got some traction. Yeah, you're right. Most of these guys aren't going to make it, but the guys who are going to make it need a support staff. They got to have guys around them to play good baseball to help them get better. That's what this is all about. It just still baffles me to think that somebody could actually bite off on this and really, truly believe this is a good idea. And let me give you an analogy. I was talking to a client today at the throwing club. I was talking to his dad, and he's a renowned dentist in the area. And he asked me the same question. What do you think is going to happen with that? Or what do you think? I said, let me ask you a question. I said, you've been a dentist now for over 20 years. He said, if you took 1 year of dental school after college, would you have been able to be in a dentist right away? He said, oh, my God, no, because I'd have been malpractice immediately. He said, I didn't know what I was doing. So it's the same thing. If you're going to take a guy right from the GCO and bump him up to low A or maybe high A, that's malpractice. The failure is part of the game, but you have to have a level of success as well. And if you're not going to have any success, then you're never going to get any prospects refined. That's what this whole process is about.
You know, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. And because I already know what your answer is going to be, because I would probably agree with it, because I think it's ridiculous that they're contracting all these minor league teams. But here's an argument that I would imagine would come from the other side here. And the idea is, yeah, that's a big jump now. But when we eliminate things, the guys that would have been in that level are just in the next level up. We're still going, you know, that person's going to end up playing. We're going to dump out guys that we don't think are going to be anything. So it isn't going to be as hard to make that jump, but we're just changing the levels, but they'll still have to work their way up. And yeah, there'll be some growing pains, but since we know that that guy got elevated too soon, we'll be able to adjust to it. This is how I think it's being justified when they're sitting around looking at it, because I think that some people look at prospects like, all right, unless you're in that top 100 MLB pipeline list, your chances of making it to the majors are slim and none. And some guys are going to make it through, but most of us are paying attention to that big list. And even on that big list of the top 100, I would say 30, 40% of them don't even pan out after a year or so. So why do we need all these other little levels? We'll just contract it a little bit and we'll just have one less step, but eventually it'll all even itself out. So I'm sure that's the argument that would be made back towards you. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, and then guys like Mike Piazza step up in your face, and, you know, here's a guy that was nearly last in the draft. And even Scott Siebel, who was in the interview with us, what did he say? He was like 64th round pick or something at the time. There's no crystal ball to know who's going to make it. And anybody who really truly thinks they're going to be able to tell that through a computer is absolutely insane. And I'm a big stats and saber guy. I am. I believe in it. But you've got to have development. You have to. There has to be a development. Elite skill acquisition is what we're talking about. And the only way to do that is to play. And the only way to get your skills better is to play with guys who are going to make you better. And you have to level that up. You have to. If that weren't the case, then you could basically take a high school player and put him in the NFL.
Right.
They would never go to college. And how would that work out?
It doesn't work out very often with high school football players. It doesn't. You know. I always think about, and it's not a Pirates player, but he's one of my favorites. He grew up well, he didn't grow up there, but he lived for a while in an area where I've lived, and his name is Mark Burley. And he only went out and started game one of a World Series and saved game two the next night, and is one of those people that there'll be an argument about whether or not he'll be up for the Hall of Fame. I don't think he'll get it because of the amount of wins that he didn't get, because I think pitchers, he was right in that transition where some guys didn't go and get as many wins as they used to. They started handing it over to bullpens and stuff, but he was part of the last time we'll probably ever see four pitchers in a row pitch complete games in a row in a postseason, because they don't do that anymore. And he was a 38th round draft pick. And that's a guy that doesn't even get a shot when you get rid of all those minor league teams. That's the name that keeps Absolutely. Sticking out to me when I think about that.
Yeah, I was really disappointed. Obviously, I have an affinity for the Appalachian League. And I read these articles about, oh, these travel is horrible and these stadiums are terrible. You know, I coached in the Appy League and so did Scott. And you know, the Western Division in the Appalachian League, the furthest travel point is 1 hour. There's no overnights. In the Eastern Division, you play all your overnights consecutively. So you're on your entire season, you're on the road three times. So that can't be it. Those arguments are invalid. Yes, there are a few stadiums that need upgrade, but those communities are willing to do that. So I just think all these are really weak, and there's just something subversive behind it. It's hard to understand.
Let me ask you this question. If it goes through, and you know, it's weird because right now when I read baseball news, I can't figure out what's real and what isn't real. Like Jeff Passan today is talking about there will be baseball. But when you open up the article, he's got nothing new. He wants it to happen. And I respect Jeff. He's a pretty good journalist, but they're all stuck with they don't know what to say. But I also look at the idea that if they do close this down and they do close down all of these different minor league teams, there's nothing that says that somebody won't start a league that's independent. The independent leagues may all of a sudden become a place where you're pulling guys later, right? I mean, you might actually have a guy that gets out, doesn't get drafted, and he goes and plays an independent league. And if he gets good instruction, they'll come knocking on his door in 3 years. Is it going to revert back to the way? I mean, think about it. I mean, if you've watched the one with Kevin Costner in the middle of the cornfield, which one is that one? Come on.
Feel the dreams.
Every time he says, you want to have a catch, I cry. Okay. Dad, you want to have a catch? I cry. A ball like a little baby.
Do not be surprised at all. Do not be surprised at all to see teams make arrangements with independent leagues this year to park some of their better players.
Right.
Do not be surprised to see that. I can tell you that there's a better chance of that happening than you would think.
I would think it'll go back to the way it used to be. It'll be one of those things where, you know, it used to be that guys played and they traveled around and they tried to get themselves noticed and then they made it to the majors. And then minor league baseball became so organized. I think you're right. I think big league clubs may sit there and say, okay, that's great, but we're gonna hide a couple of guys in the independent league and make sure that we keep in touch with them.
Yep. That's what it goes back to 4-year schools and colleges, parking guys in junior college for a year until they have scholarship available. It's the same thing.
Right. And then watch. The moment that somebody poaches a guy because he technically wasn't in the organization, they'll be adding more minor league teams.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Now I see the changes in this town. They change, they say one thing, but then the next day it's different. They change, but they don't know what they want. All they do is change. Where we'll go. No excuses, no goodbyes, no one cries.